Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Reimagine's executive editor Matt Ladner talks to Jason Bedrick, director of policy at EdChoice. The two discuss Bedrick's new study titled, Who's Afraid of EdChoice?, that examines the validity and intensity of predictions made by choice opponents over the last few decades. As Bedrick explains, rumors of public education's demise due to the expansion of more choice options for families has been greatly exaggerated. And in fact, sometimes competition through choice provides public education exactly the opposite, empirically proven improvement. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
Hello, and welcome to the Reimagined podcast. I am Matthew Ladner, and I'm very happy today to have as our guest Jason Bedrick from EdChoice, who has a delightful new study out. Every time I read it, I get a big grin on my face and start giggling uncontrollably. It's called Who is Afraid of School Choice? Jason, does this study maybe have like an alternative title that we're using informally?
It has been known affectionately around the office as the Chicken Little Study.
The Chicken Little Study, yep. I mean, in a sense, right, like we're exposed to this sort of stuff nonstop in like little doses, right? Like all you have to do is go on to Twitter or Facebook and you'll see, you know, predictably like predictions of doom, right? If you do X, if you, and it's not restricted to school choice, but school choice gets most of it, right? But basically your study is about predictions of doom that have preceded various states passing school choice programs, and you kind of like distilled them into one really powerful mixture.
Right. So, I mean, what we see is around the country, whenever there's a school choice proposal, inevitably the opponents come and say, this is going to be the end of public education. And this has been happening for a long time. Now, look, change is difficult, and any uncertainty, people worry about the effects that it's going to have on the existing system. And so it makes sense that there are some people out there that say, well, wait a second. If families can choose, that means the families that are the most interested in education are going to be the most likely to leave. And they're going to have on average, you know, the better students. And what that's going to mean is that the public schools that have to take everybody, or at least everybody that can afford to live in a certain area, but we'll set that aside, the public schools then are going to be left with less money and the harder students on average to teach. And so you're going to have this sort of vicious cycle. The public schools are then going to get worse. That's going to induce more families to leave. And then they're going to have even less money. And that means that they're going to get even worse and more families are going to leave. And it's going to lead to this death spiral and the public school system is going to be gone. Now, that may have made sense to have that worry 25, 30 years ago, but we now have several decades of experience with school choice. And so the question becomes, what is actually happening in the states that have, longstanding, robust education choice options?
Right. So could you maybe like read a couple of your favorites from the long litany of predictions of doom in the study? Do you have that available?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, if you look back a few decades, so take, for example, in Florida, we have then State Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who your listeners may know as she was the head of the Democratic National Party. I think she was she's in the U.S. House. She said on March 25th, 1999, this is the day that will go down in the annals of Florida history as the day we abandon the public schools and the day that we abandon, more importantly, our children. A few days later, Leon Russell, who was the chair of the Florida chapter of the NAACP, said this will kill public education and we're not going to let it happen. In Ohio, you had Oliver Okasek, who was the president of the Ohio State Board of Education in 1993, saying that the voucher program was the greatest threat to the public schools we have ever faced. We just have a whole long litany of these. So what we did is we, you know, to analyze the validity of these predictions, first we went, we gathered a whole bunch of these predictions up from the five states that have the oldest and most robust educational choice programs. So that would be Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin. All of them have had programs for at least a decade. In some cases, I mean, the Milwaukee voucher was enacted in 1990, although the statewide voucher in Wisconsin was 2013. So we looked at the states that have the oldest programs and also the most robust. And by that, we mean the largest percentage of students in the state participating. All of them have at least 3.5% participating. Arizona had 6.6% participating, and this is not including charter schools. And so we said, okay, well, what actually happens in these states? Is it true that the public schools end up being defunded? Is it true that you have this catastrophic effect on their performance? And in fact, the answer is no, not even close. If you go back to 2002 and you look all the way to 2019, which is the most recent year for which we have, comparable funding reporting at the federal level. So for every single state, every single one of those states has increased their per pupil spending after adjusting for inflation, every single one of them. So the schools have not been defunded in any sense of the word. As a matter of fact, there's this great report out by Aaron Smith at the Reason Foundation. And he says, well, look, to assess this claim, one thing that you could do is we often report how much money is spent per participating pupil, right? So, you know, the average scholarship size for a voucher program or tax credit scholarship program or the like. But he says, well, if you want to look at the effect on the public school system, really, you should spread it out, spread the spending out across all the students in the state, right? So take Ohio, for example. Ohio in 2019 dollars, they were spending about $15,500 per pupil at the district schools. How much are they spending per pupil statewide on their school choice programs? $226.
Right.
Arizona spends north of $10,000 per pupil. They have the most robust, they have the highest ed choice share in the country, more students participating in a private school choice program per capita than anywhere else. $10,000 for the public school students and only about $275 for the school choice students. So, yeah. I mean, it's just a ridiculous claim. And if you look to the second claim, well, what about the performance? What we do there is we look at three different things. First, we just look at the raw scores, right? I mean, did the public school system collapse? No. As a matter of fact, if you're looking at the NAEP, both the fourth and eighth grade, or if you're looking at the AP scores, they went up over this time period in every single category, right? And in most cases, they actually improved at a faster rate than the national average, particularly in Arizona and Florida, which have the most robust options. You were involved in the Education Freedom Index, along with, who else was that? Jay Green, Pat Wolf, some of the other superstars in the movement. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, you actually did a little bit of a more sophisticated analysis where, you know, you run a regression, you control for a variety of variables. And you also find a positive association between educational freedom, which you define a little more broadly than school choice, but school choice is obviously a key component, a positive association between the degree of education freedom and the NAEP scores. And so much so that it's three times as large as the average effect of an elementary school intervention on student test score gains, and about twice as large as the average effect of a middle school intervention on student achievement gains. So pretty robust finding there. Lastly, what we look at is the research on competitive effects. And here, there were 28 studies on what is the effect when you have a school voucher or tax credit scholarship program in a state, what's the effect on the public school system? 25 of the 28 find a statistically significant positive effect. So clearly these claims are just Chicken Little claims. That's why we called the report that. All the doom and gloom prophecies that opponents make every time there's a school choice program. Well, let's just look at the facts. The fact is these doom and gloom prophecies simply fail to materialize.
Right. There's a lot to unpack here. I mean, you and I both live in Arizona, the Reimagine blog is hosted in Florida. So let's talk about Arizona and Florida a little bit, right? Sure. I think the most outlandish prediction of all that you recounted in your study was from David Berliner, right, who used to be at Arizona State University. I think he's sort of a professor emeritus there now or something, right? But Berliner basically said that something to the effect that private choice programs were going to result in Kosovo-style ethnic cleansing.
Yes. He actually literally, the quote is that this was in 1999 when he was testifying, I forget which state he was in, but he was testifying on a school choice bill. And he said, this could end up resembling the ethnic cleansing occurring in Kosovo. So I cited that at the beginning, just as an example of the sort of outlandish claims that you hear. And he's not a lunatic. He's at Arizona State University. He's a professor. I mean, he is a respectable person, but it is, he sounds like a lunatic. It's an absolutely absurd claim. I included it just to say, we are setting all those types of claims aside. We were focusing in this paper narrowly on, empirically measurable effects, on things like test scores and whatnot. But you often hear outlandish claims when it comes to opponents of school choice.
Yeah, it's 22 years later, and I'm happy to report that there has been no
ethnic cleansing.
Or ethnic cleansing, and certainly not related to school choice.
I think that the whole thing in Kosovo started when they enacted a voucher program in the 1980s, right? Was that what happened? No, they don't.
I don't think so.
Wasn't vouchers? Okay. My bad.
In Florida's case, you mentioned the prediction from Representative Wasserman Schultz. This really does not stand the test of time at all, does it?
Aged like milk.
Yeah. I mean, when Wasserman Schultz made that prediction, the high school graduation rate in Florida was something around 50%. 50 statewide high school graduation rate was, you had a coin flip chance of graduating from high school in Florida in 1999. It has improved, although it's not perfect or anything, but it's improved substantially since then, right? You have much better than a coin flip chance of graduating from high school in Florida. Some years after that prediction in 1999 was made, it became apparent that Florida had fourth grade NAEP scores for Hispanic and even African American students that exceeded some statewide averages, right, for reading, fourth grade reading in English, by the way, right? And Florida became regarded as a bit of a national model for public school improvement, and rightly so, right? Here in Arizona, I wouldn't say that, we didn't have as immediate, the improvement in Arizona schools wasn't as immediate as it was under Governor Bush in Florida, but our heyday came after 2009, right? And you mentioned the Education Freedom Index, and you're right. We measured a lot of different types of charter school enrollment and open enrollment and private choice, and kind of included all of it. but, you know, contrary to Dr. Berliner's prediction of doom, you know, we saw a very large increase in choice here in Arizona after 2009, primarily, but not exclusively, because of very cheap property prices led to a substantial increase in charter school enrollment, which also led to a more active open enrollment practices in our districts, right? And we expanded private choice at the same time, right? After 2009, here in Arizona, you saw the advent of the corporate scholarship tax credit, the ESA program on the private choice side. But I mean, even in combination, the private choice and charter stuff gets overshadowed by the scale of the open enrollment going on here. And lo and behold, between 2009 and 2015, Arizona was the only state that saw statistically significant gains on all six NAEP exams given during that period. And in the more recent Stanford data, which is from 2008 to 2018, Arizona has the highest rate of academic growth for any state, including a lot of important subgroups like poor children, right? So it's these predictions of doom haven't aged well at all, as you say, aged like milk. Given that they've done so poorly in the past, surely people have become more careful over time and don't repeat this sort of thing now that there's so much evidence that they're false. Is that correct, Jason?
I wish that were correct, but unfortunately. These sorts of statements are still being made today in state legislatures and by advocates against school choice. And so one of the things we did in the second part of the study, since we were hearing all these sorts of things, is said, you know what, are these claims even at all connected to the size and scope of the proposal? So for example, we look at five different proposals that were made this past year that passed. So in West Virginia, they have an education savings account, K-12, that is nearly universal. It's for any child who is switching out of a public school or entering kindergarten. So that's 93% of kids in the state are eligible and funded. Every single child who's eligible, if they apply, they will get a scholarship. So potentially, more than 9 out of 10 kids in the state could get an ESA or what they call a HOPE scholarship in West Virginia and leave the system. Mm-hmm. Now, I can understand why opponents of school choice might be very nervous by a proposal like that, especially since they assume that anytime there's a school choice program, there's going to be a mass exodus. Now, we haven't seen a mass exodus, but what they could say is, well, there would be, but for the fact that the program is limited, there's only 10,000 vouchers available, or it's limited to, you know, low income kids, or, you know, in some states, you know, left-handed redheads or whatever it is that that we have. But in West Virginia, it's, you know, 9 out of 10 kids. In New Hampshire, it's about 3 out of 10 kids. 31% of children in the state are eligible to participate and are funded. So those are the larger proposals. But now there are three states, Kentucky, Missouri, and Arkansas, where about 4 to 5 out of 10 kids are eligible, but the funding mechanism is such that fewer than 1% of kids could participate in Kentucky or Missouri. Fewer than 0.1% of kids could actually get a tax credit scholarship in Arkansas, right? So in these states, we're talking a tiny, infinitesimally small number, right? You would not notice that these kids are participating. You know, if you're running a public school and half your kids leave, you'll notice. But if, 0.1 kids leave, you're not going to notice, right? Unless somebody told you. So then the question becomes, well, is the rhetoric of the opponents connected in some way to the scale of the proposal, right? You should expect, okay, the sort of apocalyptic rhetoric we'll see in West Virginia, but in Arkansas, where it's 0.1% of kids, no, you know, they'll probably be more mild-mannered, even tempered when they are expressing their concerns. So what we did is I came up with a 1 to 10 scale of anti-choice rhetorical intensity, you know, going from mild, moderate, strong, severe, up to catastrophic. And then we added a bonus 11, level 11 in the spirit of Spinal Tap, right? These go to 11. Right. The opponents often go to 11. So we call that apocalyptic. And then we measured the scores, and lo and behold, the average across these five states was an 8, which is a severe concern. And what we were looking at was statements, public statements from policymakers, particularly legislators and governors. But, you know, these would be offered sometimes in the press, sometimes in legislative hearings or in floor debates by district school representatives. So these would be people either from, you know, the teachers union or the school boards association or the superintendents, also various interest groups like the ACLU or Americans United Against Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And then, you know, other commentators. So, you know, op-ed writers or, you know, local newspaper editorials, those sorts of things. And, you know, so what we found is, no, across the states, it varied from about a 7.5 to 8.5 in intensity, but there was no connection. West Virginia was an 8, but Arkansas, where it was, again, 0.1% of kids could participate, was an 8.6 on the rhetorical scale. Right, Missouri was an 8.3. And in every single state, we found people who were willing to make apocalyptic statements. You know, for example, Governor Beshear in Kentucky said that the ESA proposal was the beginning of the end of public education. We had Representative David Tollett in Arkansas say, this is the last aspect of public education that has not been sold out to private interests. You know, that voting for this means putting the final nail in the coffin of public education. State Senator Reginald Thomas said, once again, we see public education with its neck inside a guillotine, getting ready to have its head cut off.
Oh, right? That one's got to be an 11, right?
That was an 11. Yeah. You know, a few other 11s here. Our friend Diane Ravitch, who is an education blogger. That's what she is today. She said, West Virginia is hurtling rapidly backward into the 19th century, you know, in the 19th century where everybody had, you know, ESAs,
right.
That they, you know, those education savings accounts that were so popular in the 19th century, in New Hampshire, State Senator Lou D'Alessandro, with whom I served back in the day when I was in the state legislature in New Hampshire, said all of this legislation is carving public education apart. So I look forward, you know, in a decade or two when I do Chicken Little Part 2, in pointing out how absurd these statements were. And, you know, hopefully in all of these states, what we're going to see is what we've seen over the last 2 to 3 decades, which is that the states with school choice, contrary, not only do the school systems not collapse, but actually the best evidence we have is that there is improvement when you have more choice and competition, that it is the rising tide that lifts all boats. As a matter of fact, we point to the most recent study in Florida by David Figlio and his colleagues, in which he said, we find evidence that as public schools are more exposed to private school choice, their students experience increasing benefits as the program scales up. And by benefits, he means higher levels of test score performance, but also lower rates of suspensions and absences. And what might explain that? Well, look at Florida. Contrary to the predictions of opponents, where there's going to be creaming and the best and the brightest are going to leave and you'll have brain drain, actually, it's the students that are doing well in the public school system tend to stay. The ones that we find on average that are leaving are not doing as well, right? So one of the things that that the researchers, what is it? I think Florida State University or University of Florida, whichever of those universities that does the annual longitudinal study of Florida's program.
Right.
What they find is they take sort of baseline results. How are these students doing that are entering the scholarship program before they take a scholarship? we find that those students are performing less well than their demographic peers, right?
Right.
In other words, it's the students that aren't doing as well, where the parents are like, you know what, this school is just not the right fit for my child. We're going to take them out. If nothing else, if the schools did not respond to competition at all, they're already going to see their test scores go up when you take the kids with the lowest test scores and send them somewhere else. Now, right. Those kids, after a few years, end up performing at the national average, which is to say they're outperforming their demographic peers, since the program is overwhelmingly low-income families and also overwhelmingly students of color, right? Students that are coming from a more disadvantaged background on net.
Right.
But what we do see is actually the public schools are responding to the competition as well, and they are improving. So it's really a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, it's a point that that I try to make frequently. The fact is that almost every single state constitution in the country, if not every last single one of them, and I'd be willing to wager every last single one of them, but there might be some exception out there, right? I haven't read the Vermont Constitution, so I'm not going to be completely confident in this, but pretty close to every single state constitution guarantees state funding for K-12 education in the districts, right? I'm not aware of any state that has tried, made any kind of even remotely serious effort to repeal that. Certainly people like you and I are not trying to do that. And if we were actually trying to destroy public education, we wouldn't be able to do it, right? And we would be deeply frustrated, bitter people, I think, right? Curses foiled again. Like, we passed these choice programs and the public schools got better. I think there's probably a mixture out there of people who, you know, just kind of believe this because it suits their priors, or because, you know, it's kind of what they're inclined to believe and haven't studied it well. Others perhaps are, you know, entirely cynical. I'm not sure, but doesn't it like speak to a kind of a deep insecurity that you continue to see these sort of predictions of doom made, even though we have decades of experience showing nothing of the sort happens?
Yeah, and I think the insecurity extends to the fact that they assume that if given a choice, families would leave, and especially the families that are most interested in education. So what does that say about the product that they are delivering? In other words, they know it's not that great, and that if parents had an option, they would go somewhere else.
Right.
But Matt, when was the last time? I don't know if you use coupons, but how often are you actually checking? Let's say this: how often, when you go to a supermarket, are you checking when you take an item off the shelf? If you even go to the supermarkets anymore and don't use Instacart, you take the item off the shelf and it says, you know, that it's 99 cents. When you go up to the counter and you ring it up, are you checking to see if it was 99 cents? I mean, if they charge you $1.19, would you notice?
Me? Probably not.
Probably not. I don't go line by line down the thing. I mean, you know, if it was a large expensive item, that's one thing, but you know, I don't notice on, you know, if it was produce, I don't really remember, you know? Mm-hmm. So that means the supermarkets could be ripping us off all the time, but they're not, because there is a small number of us out there who do this, who actually do check, and yeah, all of us benefit from those families who are checking. Well, likewise, right, in the school choice, people say, well, you know, not every family is going to be as active and involved and engaged. But the fact is, there is a large enough core of families that are active and involved and engaged. And when there's a captive audience, that there's really no feedback mechanism.
Right.
But if you have this feedback mechanism of the exit option, families can leave. That sends a message to the district, and also the families who remain in the system, because families don't just pull their kids out of a school willy-nilly, right? The kids have a whole bunch of friends at the school. They've got some attachment to the school. There's some school spirit. Maybe their parents even went to that school. It's maybe an intergenerational attachment to the school. parents don't take their kids out of a school unless it's really not working for them, right? It's not a decision that is made lightly. So when parents do start pulling their kids out of the school and taking their money with them, that sends a message to the school. And the school now has a much stronger incentive to listen to the families that are still in the school who are saying, hey, you know, you've got to step up your game here. You need to, you know, be improving the academic environment. You've got to be making sure that the classrooms are not chaotic, that it's an environment where children can learn. You've got to not be teaching, you know, crazy things that are upsetting us. These are the sorts of things that happen when you have a system of choice. It means that the provider has to be much more in tune with what the consumers, the families, are looking for.